And continuing on with June 1983 Pacific Comics coverage, I am looking at Silver Star issue number 3. Now, this is penciled by Jack Kirby, inked by Mike Royer, colored by Janice Cohen, and lettered by Mike Royer also. The cover, that is. And on the cover, we have an image of Silver Star jumping with a female clutched in one arm. Looks like they're trying to avoid something falling apart around them. We see structure and earth globs flying around. But she looks like perhaps she is fighting to be fighting against being held or being rescued or being transported by Silver Star. Which, of course, nowadays would be a no-no. Do not do anything to the female against her will. If she chooses to stay in the midst of the explosion, let her stay. That is how you have to handle that nowadays. The next breed at the top of the book here, we're told in a little circle over here to the left, this is a visual novel. And we see Homo Geneticus meets the Others as our little teaser verbiage, I guess, here. Inside front cover, Jack Kirby at his finest, Captain Victory and the Galactic Rangers, and this is a black and white mock-up of issue 11 that I just spoke of at the end of the previous episode, previous file, previous whatever you want to call it, since this is still a continuation. I don't know how to discern between the two. I just record and put them up. I don't know. Next page, premise, Homo sapiens has had it. He can't cope with the future. One man's answer, the genetic package, structure living beings who can survive an atomic holocaust. Results, Homo geneticus, strange, spectacular. Silver Star and the fearful unknown powers of his kind, the Others. So Silver Star is a Homo geneticus, and he is meeting other Homo genetici who are called the Others. We have an action image here of him jumping. Arms spread in front of him, leaping at us, thinking, a girl, either mad or dead, if I don't reach her in time. So this is kind of a setup to the image we see on the cover, it seems. Now, the inside package comes to us, scripted and penciled by Jack Kirby, colored by Janice Cohen, inked and lettered by Mike Royer. And this is, and actually I haven't been saying anything, the stories from Bernie Wrightson are not reprinted in because this book is a reprint of, and I did elucidate that. Captain Victory has several foreign reprints, but no current American reprints. Neither does the Comet story that I spoke of from Captain Victory issue number 11. Now, Silver Star, it is reprinted. Let's see, we have two stories here. One is a Silver Star 20-pager. The other is an unrelated character for 10 pages. The Silver Star story is reprinted in Jack Kirby's Silver Star that came out from Image in 2007. The backup story that I'll cover, no reprint in the U.S. There is a foreign reprint. And again, I apologize. I do not know foreign flags. I'm a rather ignorant American on top of being an ignorant male and an ignorant white person. And, there's a lot of aspects beyond me that I just am not familiar with. And I would apologize, but I wouldn't necessarily mean it because, yeah, anyway, so that's what we have. Again, more about me. But there are flags indicated and I don't recognize them. I don't know what they are. But there is a foreign reprint of, more importantly, that 10-page backup story somewhere. I want to say that that's a Swiss flag, but that just... France. I'm sorry. If I hover over it, it tells me on comics.org. Wow, I didn't know that. Okay, so there is a French reproduction of both of these in, looks like in the same book, Silver Star number 3 from Uradif Publishers, 1984. Okay, sorry. Next is a two-page spread of Silver Star breaking into the passenger side window of a car that we find is plummeting off of a cliff because it is in the middle of a... He has stumbled onto the middle of a filming of a stunt where a car has been driven off a road down, falling into the valley below by a female. Silver Star is jumping to the rescue because, first of all, he sensed something differently. He is now on the search for the Others. And he senses them or the danger that they're in, and thus they exercise their geneticosity or something. But he senses something about the individual that draws him to them. This individual is a female stunt person in a car plummeting off of a mountain that is being filmed. It's in the middle of filming. He flies and busts through the passenger side front, trying to rescue her. She is objecting. Where did you come from? Are you some kind of weirdo? Blow or you'll be killed. Come on, crazy lady. You got a half a second to escape this death trap. So he doesn't manage to pull her out. The car crashes into the valley below. We see not only does the car crash, but it crashes into a pointed upward rock, boulder, so that the car is pierced all to heck and doesn't just smush. Well, he lives because he's homogeneticus, and she lives because, well, she must be too, come to find out. He said she's only able to live because she was able to intensify their molecular structure to the degree of phenomenal density at the moment of impact. In short, Miss Geneticus, you're one of my kind. You're one of my kind. Yeah, there's a song in there somewhere. So they're talking here amongst the rubble of the crashed car at the bottom of the valley. Now the filming peoples, the producer, the showrunner, the camera. Hey, what are you doing? Cut the camera. They're going on and on. And Silver Star notices he feels something is going to happen. And he poofs everybody to safety. Everybody is 3, 6, 9, 11 other people and them, Silver Star and this woman that he's been drawn to. He poofs them to probably his home, which he's going to know and be able to teleport to rather readily, because he sensed danger. And then when he senses the danger is clear, after getting quite a bit of pushback from all these human beings that are being just transported hither and yon without their approval or knowledge or warning or anything, he poofs them back. And we see that there is a huge burning energized hole in the ground now, because Silver Star feels apparently that Darius Drum did something, sent a missile or just caused this to explode or what. It's at this point, it's kind of hard to say, because Darius apparently being genetic Kai himself, if geneticously, whatever, one of homogeneticus, is able to do anything that Kirby needs the bad guy to be able to do. He's kind of the anti Mary Sue or whatever they... And I know that that's not necessarily the most favorable phrase to use nowadays, but it's the only one I know. And there's a male version of it too, a Mary Sue, a something something. But that basically that's the a character in a story. Negatively, it's looked at very negatively now. That seemingly always has the power or ability or knowledge or skill to get anybody out of anything. And you know, I mean, it seems like they're not necessarily all powerful, but they always seem to have the ability to save the day in the story. And back many, many years ago, the phrase Mary Sue was coined for that in female characters. And then, like I said, there's the same acknowledgement for male characters, but I don't run across it as readily as I do the term Mary Sue. Either way, that's what Darius is being used for by Kirby. He's the big bad. And so, back to the story here, he did something and caused this section of the Mother Earth to explode. Silver Star rescued everybody that would have been affected, and when they pop back, they see that something has occurred. Next, this young lady, let's see, what did she ever give it a name? Yes, Norma Richmond is her name. And she and Silver Star next travel to a baseball game, because they're interested in the batter, who is known as Home Run Hunter. Just as they get there, Hunter is up to bat, and Silver Star realizes that Darius is himself the pitcher, and he has thrown the ball at the batter, like you're supposed to do in the game of baseball. But something probably is going to happen when the bat strikes that ball, in that Hunter is that good. And I don't know, I figure that Darius kind of tossed him a softball to hit anyways. But sure enough, Hunter hits it, and there is a huge explosion that trashes that whole half side of the stadium. Silver Star is knocked out when he comes to. Norma is not there because she has been helped up and now is accompanying Darius Drum on his journeys to find others, to find more of the others, much as Silver Star is doing. Now, I don't know that his intent, Darius, is to necessarily destroy them all, but I suspect because he knew how close Silver Star was to finding Home Run Hunter, he decided to just destroy him rather than give Silver Star even an opportunity to recruit him. Much as Silver Star has seemingly recruited Norma, although now she is in the clutches of Darius Drum, uber bad guy. So we then cut back to Bradford Miller and Walter Hammer, the two doctors discussing what Bradford has done in putting together this genetic package that these various peoples of Earth have been seeded with. Silver Star, Darius Drum, Norma Richmond, Home Run Hunter, who actually his name was John Blaney Hunter, and more. So we see a little bit of back and forth, more about the origins of the concept here from the two doctors, one who was directly involved and the other who was a confidant, shall we say. Moving on to Albie Reinhardt, our next other, who is playing as a strong man in a circus. To show his prowess, he is holding aloft an entire giant carousel with people riding on it and spinning and everything like that. And he's underneath the central hub of it, holding it aloft. Darius and Miss Richmond pop up. Miss Richmond is objecting to her treatment, so Darius gives her the homogeneticus whammy here and just kind of knocks her insensate. She's not unconscious, but she is in kind of like a being held kind of like in a coma or something like that. But Drum causes the carousel to start spinning faster and faster and faster. Now it's spinning so fast that it's just throwing parts of itself off. It's spinning so fast. And this spinning is more than Albie is able to hold aloft with his hands, and it falls down onto his chest and it's spinning. So it's seemingly going to burn straight through him or burn him up or whatever. At that point, Silver Star notices this emanation from another homogeneticus that he is in trouble. And so he poofs away from the house where he has been having this conversation with Bradford Miller and Walter Hammer to go rescue Albie. Coming next, the good, the bad, and the miserable, Satan's children. So those must be more homogeneticuses, geneticae that have banded together. Next page is the letters page. Of note is a letter from Thomas Kovacs of Zurich, Switzerland, that includes a drawing of King Kirby running at us, rather heroically holding a pencil, clutching a pencil, shall I say, and with a pipe in his mouth exclaiming, "It's drawing time," I guess, kind of like the things, it's clobbering time. Yeah. Couple other letters, Tony Yates, Steve Thomas, and DS. DS is a response to Tony's letter. Next page is the beginning of the story, The Golden Girl. This is scripted by Richard Kyle, penciled, inked, and lettered by D. Bruce Perry, and colored by Janice Cohen. And this is cool because the first the last panel of page 5 ends it. But up until then, almost 5 full pages of narrationless panels. Nobody speaks. Now there are, like, there's a letter here and you can see some part of the letter. There's some signs in the part of the Bowery that they're at and you can read those. So it's not textless, but there's no speaking and no narration. So a young lady is, a letter is delivered to a young lady who immediately upon delivery is on the other side of the door and snatches it up, reads it, runs out, jumps onto a cable car. Now, this is in the Bowery, so I guess at this time, we don't know what year it was, but I guess at some point the Bowery would have had a cable car. It does in this story. She's being pursued by a gentleman with a top hat and cane, chases her down. She runs to the waterfront, and he is there. She jumps onto a train and opens up her letter and reads it a second time, and he is in the panels of the train. She walks down from the EL to a street past 372 and a half, whatever street. The gentleman follows her down from the EL. She sees his reflection in the door at 372 and a half, knows that he's still following her. She's distancing herself now. She's about half a block ahead of him, walking through a section of the Bowery here. Finally, we get some indication that this is Flynn, A Story of Old New York, Chapter 1, The Golden Girl. Here it is, Brooklyn, April 9, 1894. So I guess Brooklyn is the borough and the Bowery is a section of Brooklyn. For those of you that live or know about New York, you'll have to correct me if I'm wrong, but from the way this is being spoken of, I'm assuming that's what it is. I know I've heard of Brooklyn. I'm pretty sure I know that it's a borough. I've heard of the Bowery, but what place geographically in New York it fills, I do not know. I'll go with the assumption that it is a section of the borough of Brooklyn. Gentleman is following her, and we're seeing all kinds of other persons here of Brooklyn, kids playing on the sidewalk in the street, people just leaning up against the support structures for the EL, underneath of which Miss Flynn is running, or not Miss Flynn. What is her name? Yeah, I don't think we're told her name, are we? Let's see. Williams. Yeah, we are. Holly Elizabeth Williams is going to be her name. But she's running. She's dressed in 1894 women's attire. She's got a blouse on and a skirt. But interesting, this two-page spread, and we see Easter eggs for people. We have Miriam Leonida fortune-telling. We have Royer Best Deals. We have Brenner's Hotel. We have Mike Ryer Royer Pawn Shop. We have Dr. Frederick Patton, dentist. We have the Kirby Pool Hall. So a lot of Easter eggs there in this section of the Bowery. Miss Williams turns and sees full on that this gentleman is still following her, and she freaks out a little bit and continues on to her destination. Runs up some stairs, brushes by a gentleman that pays her more than passing attention, goes inside, speaks to the woman here, and the woman points on into the drawing room, which has a mix of men and women here, leading me to believe that the woman is the madam of the brothel, that this is the common room for. We have a gentleman finally that speaks. I'm John Black, and I've been waiting for you for a long time. You are our Miss Williams, aren't you? He speaks to her, and he's very condescending. He speaks to her. Just everything about this interaction is condescension of the woman from the man. I'll just put it that way. Finally, they step off into a room to be by themselves with the madam. So it's Miss Douglas, Holly, Elizabeth Williams, and John Black are all in this room. Your letter said you could tell me where my father is, she says finally. And he says, and so I can, Miss Williams, but first you're going to write a letter for me. Pen and paper, Miss Douglas. And he's pulled a firearm on Miss Williams, and he's holding her at gunpoint, telling her, dated yesterday, April 8, 1894, I, Holly Elizabeth Williams, authorized the bearer to receive in my name all properties of Robert M. Williams traveling as James Allen, and that's as far as we get, because we cut to the same gentleman that's been following her, walking up the stairs into the brothel, cut back to Miss Williams, as his sole heir, cut back to the gentleman who has gotten into the house by the proprietress, Miss Douglas here. And back to the dude telling Miss Williams to write the letter, back to this individual who comes upon the gentleman holding a gun to Miss Williams' head, and she fights back, draws the attention of the guy that's been following her. He is stopped by the male kind of bodyguard that you often see in brothels, but not a bodyguard. He's the security, right? Usually a scruffy male of some sort that's used to getting into fights, that tries to restrain this gentleman, who we're going to find out is Dan Flynn. To no avail, he goes to her rescue, throws the security through the door, and disarms this John Black, but he knows this gentleman as Argus, and his name actually is Daniel Flynn, and he presents Miss Williams with his business card, and it says Argus Detective Agency on it. So this is Daniel Flynn of Argus Detective Agency, but John Black knows this individual as Argus. Not sure how that goes. Chases him off. He hands his business card to Miss Williams, says he's there to help, and that's the end of the story. Next page is more letters. Let's see. Gary, Larry Stevens, Dennis Pilichus, and Stephen Goronsky. Advert for Captain Victory and the Galactic Rangers, issue number 11. Both at the bottom of this letters page, about a quarter of the page, but then the entire back cover, it uses this same cover for Captain Victory, the issue that I spoke of earlier this episode, in a subscription form. Same six books. And then on the back page tells us Flynn, written by Richard Kyle and drawn by D. Bruce Barry, a story of old New York, starting this issue. And we have that same image of this particular street in the Bowery with all of these Easter eggs on it. And this was drawn by Bruce Barry. All right. So that is Silver Star issue number 3. Now our fourth and final book for this Pacific Comics June 1983 coverage is Twisted Tales number 3. All right, our cover comes to us penciled, inked, and colored by Mr. Richard Corbin, and we see below, it's pretty much just the lower half of the cover. The top half is the Twisted Tales logo and Pacific Comics and all that. But the art is of a, looks to be a dinosaur of some sort, that on the right-hand side of the cover, a police officer is shining a flashlight on, illuminating the head, bloody mouth, a bloody forearm here that is holding some parts of an individual, either it's supposed to be entrails or a spine. And on the ground here at its feet, we see a hand and arm and a face, maybe whole head down here that the dinosaur has. Looks like the dinosaur has been interrupted in the process of eating someone, interrupted by via the flashlight of the officer here. Now the first, the inside front cover is letters page from three individuals here. We see a John W. Taylor, who is an assistant professor of English and linguistics at South Dakota State University. Mitchell Turner and Edward Darton, D-A-R-T-O-N, Darton. All right, the first story. That is scripted by Bruce Jones, penciled, inked, and lettered by Richard Corbin, and colored by Steve Olaf. And it involves a young man named Jason Cullen. Now, the story opens on a farm out in the middle of nowhere. It looks like a couple police officers have rolled up. They're looking for someone. They're calling for Mr. Cullen. So I would assume that's who they're looking for. Walking around, checking things out, they open up. They go into the barn, which is partially open, and they freak. And we immediately go back in time to some unknown point previous to this. We see a young man sitting in a schoolroom, and he is misbehaving and being switched with a ruler by the teacher. This is going to turn out to be Jason Cullen. After school on the way home, he gets waylaid by a dude that beats him up because he doesn't have any money to give him. Wilbur is the bully's name. The young Mr. Cullen picks up his books and heads on home, where his pa, which I assume is his dad, but could be his grandpa, but whoever is taking care of the young man, waylays into him about being late and talking back and not bringing him his supper and all this kind of stuff. Starts beating him with, looks like his cane. So the boy breaks away from that and goes to the barn where they have chickens to see if there's any eggs to cook something for dinner. And he sees a big egg under where the nest boxes are for the chickens, and picks it up, and it starts to hatch, and out pops a little baby T-Rex. So he leaves it in the barn, gets a couple of the chicken eggs, and goes back. He gives the chicken eggs to the baby T-Rex because it needs to eat. He goes and tries to find something else and comes back with a squirrel that he makes up for his dad or his grandpa or whatever he may be there. Goes back to school, comes back, feeds the dinosaur more. He's got a squirrel for the dinosaur himself. then comes back another day and finds that the T-Rex has gotten out of the barn and has killed the neighbor's dog, the Millers. So he hurries up and gets the dinosaur and ushers it back into the barn. Takes some more gruff from his dad here because his dad thinks that the boy killed the dog because the dog was trying to kill their chickens. And either the dad would prefer to do that or the dad was mad that the boy didn't clear that with him or something. But that is a reason to beat the boy. We see more bonding between the boy and the dinosaur. Another butt-kicking from Wilbur one day here goes back and sees that the dinosaur has killed another neighbor's dog and finally decides to chain the dinosaur up in the barn to keep it from getting out. Finally, after having lost at least two dogs, the neighbor comes onto the Cullens property looking for the dog, either dog, and the boy's not sure what to do, Finally, he tells the neighbor, Mr. Miller, well, I think the dog is in the barn here, and it's go through here and you'll see. And he leads Mr. Miller into the barn, closes and locks the barn door from the outside behind Mr. Miller, and by the sounds of it, the T-Rex kills Mr. Miller. Well, this, you know, the boy is not as cold-hearted as he seemed, right? He did this out of self-preservation, but now as he goes to bed and he's in school, he starts to have second thoughts. Well, at some point, the teacher finally gets fed up with young Mr. Cullen and goes home with him to speak to the dad. And the young boy tells the teacher that his dad is working here in the barn. And so she goes in and he locks the door behind her, and she is seemingly killed by the dinosaur. At some point later, Wilbur is beating up on the kid, and Cullen says, well, I don't have any money on me, but I know where there's some at. Come on and follow me. So you can presume that Cullen fed the bully Wilbur to the dinosaur. Later on, the police stop by looking for Mr. Miller or wanting to speak to the boy's dad. And the boy's like, well, both of them are here in the barn. They're talking. So if you go in there. And he locks the door behind the police officer, and the T-Rex kills the cop. So finally, the boy sees that he can't keep going at the rate he's going, so he's going to have to do something. He goes and gets a shotgun, and he kills the T-Rex. Now, we cut back to immediately after the opening of the story, where the two officers have gone into this barn, and we see that there are bodies everywhere. We see that there's art on the walls of the barn of a T-Rex or some kind of dinosaur. Sorry, if you guys are hearing other things, my cat is assaulting the microphone as I'm trying to speak into it. So, artwork of the dinosaur taking care of various individuals on the wall. We see various parts of individuals here on the floor. We see the policeman's ammo bandolier, I would assume. We see bones and skulls and hands and looking around. Finally, the officers find Cullen's dad, who has been chained up and has been eating people. And he says, gleep, gleep. So apparently, the boy did not find a dinosaur. He took his dad out to the barn and chained him up. And then because the dad didn't have food or wasn't able to eat or whatever, he went crazy from lack of food. But to keep him going, Cullen introduced all these other people to the dad. But ultimately, the dad got a hold of the boy. I'm not sure. But ultimately, only the dad is left. And he's crazy chained. That's all we know for sure. I'm not sure where the boy went in all of this story. And I'm not sure where the break was from reality to this dream state that we saw that the boy was narrating. So, not sure. Next page is an advert for Fantagore Press. Fantagore presents Brood Part 2, now available Jeremy Brood Part 1, Relativity, and Mutant World. All of these are available at your local comics specialty shop or by mail from your favorite mail order dealer, Fantagore Press. So that's another comic book publisher that is advertising in Pacific Comics books, Fantagore Press. And again, I apologize. Something has ignited the affection of my cat, and her name is Aubrey, and she's just all over the microphone and me and the comic as I'm trying to read it and my notes as I'm trying to look at them. And yeah, so hang on just a sec. Okie dokie, and after an indeterminate amount of time, I have returned with story 2 of 4 from this issue of Twisted Tales, issue number 3. This is from Bruce Jones, Doug Wildey, Pencils, Inks, and Colors, and Kerry McCarthy Letters. And this is a story about Rick and Pat Washburn. Rick and Pat Washburn. Rick is a screenwriter, and he and his wife are on a break. Apparently, it's the first break that they have had together in quite a while, and they're in a tropical setting here with a boat and dock and a quaint little house, and they get it on adult style here. And then in the midst of this, after their session, while she's wearing a completely see-through negligee, she opens up cabinets and is beset upon by, I assume they're supposed to be spiders, but they look like a variety of sea star. I think they're supposed to be spiders. They're all over her. She screams, saying, "They're eating me." Rick grabs her, throws her down in the living room, grabs some of the wood from the fireplace, and starts to chase them off of her using the fire. She screams at him to stop, that he's setting her on fire, but he drives off all the spiders. And when they get, you know, however far away from everybody, they seemingly just disappear. Well, later that night, they're getting ready for some more adult time when she attacks him with a knife, but then starts to choke, which stops the attack, and she falls to the floor. He goes to help her because she's choking, and she doesn't have the knife any longer and doesn't even remember doing that. After that, a wild cat of some sort, we'll call it a lynx, it looks like, but I don't think it is by the size, jumps through the window and starts attacking the guy. Pat runs to the closet and grabs a rifleman kind of shotgun with the under part cocking mechanism like the rifleman used, and is about to shoot the cat, but it's vanished. And Pat and Rick talkie talk, but they see that the damage that was inflicted on him by the cat now is gone. And so they're sitting here trying to figure out what in the world is going on. It's been, what, 1, 2, 3 high weirdness things almost back to back. And then Rick hits on something here. He says, "It's the movie, the script I gave to Ted Patterson, because I couldn't think of an ending. Only he did think of an ending, several endings, and he's still thinking of them. The screenplay, The Terror in the Woods, is about us, remember? The couple in the script even have our names, Rick and Pat. We're living it. I always wanted more realism in movies, but now She says, "Darling, you've had a terrible fright. You're exhausted. You're imagining." And he says, "Am I? Did I imagine that you attacked me a few minutes ago with a butcher knife? Come on, we're getting out of here." So they get dressed and they start to run out to the boat, but they are beset upon by a plague of rats, and the rats chase them out the pier onto the boat. They get on the boat and start heading home. Halfway home on the trip, Rick chokes, falls unconscious. He regains consciousness. They park the boat. They jump in their little sporty car, and they're heading to Patterson's house, but they get caught up in the middle of a snowstorm. They ditch the car because it won't go any farther, and head out on foot. And they make the dude's house, and suddenly it changes from winter to summer. And they get to the dude's house, and they tell him what all's been going on, and he doesn't believe him. And he's like, "Well, it doesn't really matter. I can't finish the script because the typewriter went kablooey on me. The A kept sticking, so I just threw it in the trash." And yeah, that's the end of that one. Okay. Full color cover mock-up this time of issue number 11 of Captain Victory for their call for subscription. Same 6 books it has been. The next story, entitled With Honor, is scripted by Bruce Jones, penciled and inked by Bill Ray, colored by Steve Olaf, and lettered by Kerry McCarthy. And this involves 2 Japanese soldiers, August 26, 1942, we're told, somewhere in the South Pacific, named Kurusu and Nitaki. Their boat sinks off of some Pacific island. They are the only 2 survivors. They make a pact to live or die together. And one night they see a boat One of them stays hidden. The other goes to check the boat. Let's see. Kurusu stays hidden while Nataki goes out and checks the boat. And then after a period of time, Nataki comes back. He says, it's one of ours, Kurusu. We're safe. But the problem is there's only one, only room for one. So he leaves his samurai sword and all his survival gear and everything for Kurusu, and Nataki take off. Kurusu says, well, here, before you go, this is a picture of my wife and a letter for her. Would you give those to her? And so Nataki stays. And, or no, Kurusu stays. Nataki is the one that left. So now we have several incidents of Kurusu by himself surviving. Nataki showing up with things, with items to keep him alive, with new clothes, with new equipment, with new whatever. So periodically, Nataki will make it back, but it's only ever room for one other person on whatever conveyance he uses to get there. So Nataki is always able to leave while Kurusu is left staying on the island. Until one time, Nataki comes back. Well, we see a scene here finally where Nataki realizes what's going on. He's eating rations out of one of his cans, and he sees the date on it, and he just goes berserk. So when, or Kurusu does, when Nataki comes back that time, Kurusu kills him, and we find out that it is 15 years this little game has been going on. And so Kurusu kills Nataki, leaves him, and finally is able to leave the island. We're told that he walks through the jungle past the bulldozers, past the hurricane fence, past the U.S. Marine Corps training base towards the airport that will take him once more to his little wife, Sensu, to home. Before that, he tosses aside the Bushido blade in disgust and walks out of the clearing for the first time in 15 years. So they've been playing this game for 15 years. Dude kind of just lost track of time is how it was able to go so long. And then seeing the expired date on the ration tin that he had, he realized... And the jig was up. Full page ad for Pacific Comics Presents Elric on sale now. Elric of Melniboné issue 1, which I've already spoken of. And then our fourth and final story, Sunken Chest, scripted by Bruce Jones, penciled and inked by Brett Blevins, colored by Steve Olaf, lettered by Kerry McCarthy. Now, I will say I first ran into and remember Brett Blevins from a run that he did in the, late 80s, early 90s on New Mutants, late 50s, early 60s with Bird Brain and all those guys. And he did an issue of X-Men. I think it was in the, about that same time, would have been in the 200s, 215 to 220, 225, in there somewhere, where his art was very... exaggeratedly, almost horrifically cartoony is all I can say from my mind's eye without sitting looking at the art while I'm trying to describe it. But that was Brett Blevins to me, and this artwork doesn't strike me as that at all. This is intended to be much more realistic, better art, I guess, in a lot of ways. And it is about Scott Reardon, a boat owner, ocean tour captain, and Ted and Jill Hansen. They're a rich couple. Ted is overweight and brash, and Jill is svelte and blonde and adorned in a bikini, to show you the memes that we're playing with here. And Reardon is just a normal, tough captain, boat captain dude. So he's taking them out on a day on the sea, and Ted is wanting to sport fish and land, you know, some giant sailfish or shark or whatever. And his wife just, whatever, she's not interested. She's just laying out on the boat to do something. She has been reading an issue of Tales of the Crypt, oddly enough. And Reardon is salivating over her, and Ted is completely ignoring her, throwing spent beer cans next to the cooler that they brought on board while he's sitting here with a big sport fishing rod hoping to kill something. So he comes on to his wife and says, hey, let's go below and get it on. And she's like, no. And Reardon starts to get in the way but doesn't. And because of that, she decides to go ahead and go with her husband to keep any problems from cropping up between the two men. She emerges later, has a quick talk with the Captain Reardon before Ted pokes his head up and calls for his wife to come back down below deck for seconds. The next day, just the same behaviors by all three of them. The Reardon is making over the wife who is being abused by the husband. Come upon a little tropical island here, and Scott gets the idea to take Ted scuba diving. So he takes him out to a portion of the bay where Ted steps onto a giant clam and gets caught up in the clam. And then as the tide rises, he drowns. Ted makes it back to the boat, comes on to the wife, Jill, telling her what he's done, and she has none of it, and tells him to go find her husband and bring her back. This is not what she wanted or anything, so you need to go get him or else. So Scott goes out to find Ted and finds that there is nobody there, but he does find a bloody knife that has washed ashore there. Goes back to the boat to tell Jill that, hey, I went looking for your husband, but I wasn't able to find him. They both turn in that night, and Scott is awoken by a gruesome nightmare that is the remains of Ted haunting him. The next day, just as they're getting ready to take off, the Coast Guard comes up on them. And in the midst of discussions with the Coast Guard, Scott is playing at fishing here, and he catches something, and it's a big shark. And so everybody from the Coast Guard ship jumps over to his ship to egg him on and help him land this big shark and everything. 2, 4, 6, 7 guys here. 2, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 guys there. So there's the full complement of the Coast Guard boat. Comes over and he lands the shark and hoists it up, and they see that there's something in the shark's mouth that falls out. And it is the partially eaten torso of Scott Hansen with the words "Reardon did it" cut into his chest. So, I don't know, maybe Ted, I guess he cut that into his chest with the knife. And then for whatever reason, the clam either let him go or that's what it is. I see here in the image that there is a portion of the leg still caught in the clam. So, using the knife that he had on him from where he went scuba diving, Ted cut the words "Reardon did it" into his chest, but then the shark swam by and bit him in half, leaving a portion in the clamshell, eating the rest of it, and this is the portion that just fell out of the shark's mouth with the message. Add for Edge of Chaos, which I think I've already said we'll be talking about next episode, I believe. And then we have a advert on the inside back cover for Michael Moorcock's Elric of Melniboné, Issue 2. And on the back cover is an mock-up, an advert for the cover of Alien Worlds, Issue number 3, on sale in June. And that is our fourth and final issue of June 1983 from Pacific Comics. So thanks for hanging in there for almost 2 hours for me, guys, while I talked about those books. Let's see. Next up, it looks like from Newsprint Commando, we will be talking about X-Mutants 5 from Amazing Comics. And then immediately after that will be another Pacific Tuesday, where I'll be talking about the aforementioned Chaos book, issue number 1, and Gru the Wanderer, issue number 4. So those are the next two offerings from the Newsprint Commando. That is me. If you have any questions or feedback, all that was at the top of the show. This is the end of the show. See you next time. Ciao, Bella.